there's no light.
Well, there is a light, but...
Oh, there's a light?
Let's hope it's on.
There we go.
Oh, there we go. Okay. Okay, this is not the House Committee on Education. This is the High School and Transition Success for Students with Disabilities Task Force. It is February 13th. We have a new member. Senator Close has resigned from the committee, and we... Senator Dembro, would you like to introduce yourself?
I'm Michael Dembro. Now a state senator representing Senate District 23. I had been in the House. And I see some familiar faces. Done a lot of work with education and human services and Sarah and Victoria. And so when the request came from the president's office for me to take this spot, when I heard what it was about, I eagerly accepted. This is very good work that's being done here.
And one of the really neat things about Senator Dembro is that he has done a lot of work around higher education coordination and a lot of work, particularly around community colleges and increasing the number of kids that are going on from high school to higher ed. So I was really pleased when I found out you would be our new member. And it might be helpful, just since Senator Dembro is new, just to do quick around-the-table introductions, maybe to refresh all of our memory, and maybe we can start down at the end.
I'm Sally Simich, and I'm from Oregon Department of Education, and my area is secondary transition.
I'm Danielle Sheldrake. I'm the Administrator for Student Services for the Beaverton School District.
And I'm Sarah Mendez. I'm the Registrar at South Salem High School.
And I'm Mike Mailer with the Department of Human Services, and my specific job now is the Statewide Employment First Coordinator.
Agenda, Disability Rights Oregon.
Sarah Gelser, represented from Corvallis.
Raina Mattson, Newport High School, Newport Prep Academy Counselor.
Matt Loring, Principal, Corvallis High School.
Susan Deegan, Oregon Student Access Commission.
Clint DeLongpre, Vocational Counselor with State of Oregon Vocational Rehabilitation.
Well, thank you all for coming today. Before we go into the informational meeting, there are a couple of updates from the last time we met. You might recall at the last hearing we had some testimony from a young woman named Natalie who talked about her experience with the essential skills. Since we had that meeting, she actually went and met with the governor and Dr. Golden, and she did a really great job meeting with the governor and Dr. Golden. Conversation has begun around what our requirements are around high school graduation, both as it relates to the essential skills and as it relates to credits, and might we be able to look at a more broadened view of high school diplomas or some more of a tiered kind of way of looking at diplomas. So we were able to amend into a bill that will be on the House floor tomorrow, something that's more formal around that. It will direct the Department of Education to be making some recommendations by January 1st of next year to the state board and to the legislature about the outcome of the implementation of the essential skills in the first 3 years, looking at what number of kids aren't graduating but for the essential skills, what is that impact on transition into post-secondary, what is that impact on financial aid, and just generally looking at Oregon's graduation requirements. Are there any modifications that we might want to make going forward that would create more opportunities to maintain rigorous and high standards, but also create more pathways for long-term success for all students. The other thing that is in that, Natalie talked about that a little bit, it will put in the statute the clarification that students, when they do their work samples to demonstrate essential skills, would be able to use any accommodation that they had been allowed to use to earn regular credit in high school. And we put kind of a list of including but not limited to, so not everybody's accommodation is listed, but we were very careful to include text-to-speech and speech-to-text in the statute. So it's attached to a bill that has a lot of things going on, so we'll see how healthy that bill is 2 weeks from now, Senator Dembro, when it makes it through the Senate, hopefully intact. And but that, I was excited that we were able to make that progress from our last meeting, and hope all of you will engage in that conversation with the department about how we might look at what some of those barriers are for kids. And a lot of people around the table participated in a variety of different places in conversations about that, actually four or five of you, so thank you. So today we had we have four things on the agenda, and we are going to start with an informational meeting on financial aid. and the issues around financial aid, and Susan is going to lead us through that.
Okay, just, and I must say, Representative Gelser and Senator Dembro, it's going to be really hard to say Senator Dembro because I went through a number of hearings last session with Representative Dembro, so if I mess up, my apologies.
I do still as well.
So. Oh, good. Good. And for you, in fact, this may be a very simple overview. What I wanted to do was to kind of go through both the federal and state financial aid programs, the general programs that college students, especially lower income, higher need college students, are eligible to receive. And the main reason for this is to kind of give you an idea of what is on the table, particularly for students who have modified diplomas and extended diplomas, because at this point they are no longer eligible for federal student aid. They're only eligible for the Oregon Opportunity Grant. So I will work through these a little bit so that you have some sense of what these programs are and the dollar amounts that are on the table for these students, because I think that is to say they lose the Pell Grant is one thing. To say they're losing a Pell Grant that's worth more than $5,000 means something else. I mean, that's much more, I mean, that's a bigger deal. So as far as federal student aid is concerned, the main sources of financial aid most college students are likely to have, the federal Pell Grant, the Federal Supplemental Education Opportunity Grant, usually referred to as SEOG. That is a smaller program for very high-need students, and it's a much smaller and smaller in terms of size and in terms of the number of students that are served. You also have the standard student loans, the Stafford loans, both subsidized and unsubsidized. Subsidized and unsubsidized means essentially whether the interest is being paid for the students while they're in college. In some cases, if they're low enough income and they qualify for a subsidized loan, they don't begin having to pay interest on their loans until they actually enter repayment. For students with subsidized loans, interest accrues from the time they take out the loan. PLUS loans is a slightly different category. Those loans are for parents or for graduate and professional students. But for PLUS loans, parents can borrow up to the cost of education for a student each academic year. So they can be pretty significant as well. And then the Perkins loans, which is also a smaller loan program and one that the feds have been trying to phase out over the last few years. So whether they'll finally succeed in making the Perkins loan program go away and rolling what's left of it into the Stafford loan program, we'll see probably when we get to the next reauthorization of Higher Education Act. And then we have the federal work-study program for those students who qualify. They have a work component where they are allowed to work up to, I think it's 15 hours a week, and they can help pay for part of their college that way as well. So this is probably the most critical slide to give you a sense of this is what the award maximum award amounts were for the current academic year for 13-14. For the academic year that begins 14-15, the federal Pell Grant will go up to $57.30. It goes up $85. So, you know, that's a fair amount of money. That grant is based on need, cost of attendance, enrollment status, and whether the student is attending full-time or part-time, full year or part year. The SEOG grant is up to $4,000 a year, also based on need. Pell recipients who have the highest level of need are the ones who are most likely to get that grant. And it's a fund that is kind of managed at the campus level. It's one of the so-called campus-based programs. In most cases, students do not get $4,000 a year. many of the highest need students will receive maximum awards of $2,000 to $3,000 just because the campus only has a certain amount of money available to distribute among a large group of students. And then with the direct loan programs, those are the Stafford loans, students can receive up to $7,500 a year. The amount of the loan is based upon their grade level. So if they are first or second year students, I think their award limits, if I remember correctly, are limited to $3,500. And those award amounts go up the longer that they are in college. And again, some have subsidized interest. The Perkins loan is up to $5,500 a year. That amount is also based on needs. So these are primarily need-based programs other than the Stafford program. So these are all federal programs that are available to most college students. These are the eligibility criteria for the Pell Grant. They are very similar to the Oregon Opportunity Grant eligibility criteria. And that's one of the reasons I gave you the handout, was so that you wouldn't have to take notes and try to write all of this stuff down.
And it's all in OLIS, too, so your electronic.
Yeah, so it's there. And yeah, Social Security number, undergraduate. They have to be undergraduate students. Students who have a prior baccalaureate degree of some kind are not eligible for a Pell Grant. Now, a community college student who is in a certificate program and then picks up a second certificate and then maybe an AA degree, that is fine because none of those degrees or credentials are baccalaureate degrees. So a student could spend 4 years or could spend half of his or her 4 years or 6 years of eligibility at the community college level, earn several certificates and an AA degree or a transfer degree, and then still be able to go on and complete an undergraduate degree in some cases. Now, here's the element that's in red is the one thing that has changed. That students, they have to be qualified to obtain post-secondary education by having a high school diploma or GED certificate or by having a high school education in a homeschool setting approved under state law. Unfortunately, the term high school diploma is not defined. But in the case of the state of Oregon, it has been determined that a modified diploma does not meet the definition of high school diploma for these purposes.
Who makes that decision? Is that ODE or is that?
That was the U.S. Department of Education, and I don't know if it's still posted on the Department of Education website, but several years ago there was a one-page letter that was written by one of the deputy secretaries, Dan Bedzelen, who has since retired. But the decision, it was very clear that the Oregon Department of Education had asked the department to make a ruling on this, and that was the ruling. So I have a marked-up copy of it that might be in my bag that I can show you. I tried to find it on the Oregon Department of Education website a few weeks ago, but I haven't been able to find it. So,
is this a policy that's consistently implemented nationwide, as far as you know?
Senator Dembro, it's an excellent question, and I'm really not sure. There's not been much discussion at all that I have seen about this issue. It's something that I could certainly ask people at the department about if they know. I could also contact my colleagues at other state agencies that administer need-based grants like the Oregon Opportunity Grant and find out if they have similar kinds of situations in their states.
I think that they do. At National Council on Disability, we did a brief on the impact of that law change, because across the country, less than 50% of kids on IEPs nationwide leave with a regular high school diploma. There's only 12 states that have more than 50% of students with disabilities getting a regular diploma, and I think there are more than 23 that have less than 30% getting a regular diploma. So in a lot of places, the community colleges and vocational colleges and technical colleges, they had been writing to Senator Harkin's office talking about the kids that were no longer able to enroll in their programs after this change because they had vocational diplomas or high school or modified diplomas, whatever it was that they call technical diploma in their state.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's just us.
No, but it would be useful to see if any states have found a way around this.
Yeah. The other piece that's in here is that third bullet, effective January 1st, of 2012, that students cannot qualify for federal student aid by passing an ability to benefit test. Until a year and a half ago, a student who did not have a high school diploma had this third option. If that student could pass an ability to benefit test, and both the SAT and ACT were considered ability to benefit tests, they could still qualify for federal student aid. So an adult learner, for example, who maybe dropped out of high school 10 or 15 years ago and never had a diploma, didn't want to go through the GED process, could take the ability to benefit, and if that person passed, could qualify for financial aid, federal aid, to attend a community college. But that is no longer the case. As far as applications are concerned, there are two main applications. The free application for federal student aid, the FAFSA, is the application for federal student loans, Pell Grants, SEOG, Perkins, you name it. It is the gateway application. Students have to apply online. They have to complete a FAFSA each year, and the main reason for that is, especially for need-based programs, your financial resources or your financial status could change from year to year, or the number of people in the household could change from year to year, or the number in college could change from year to year. So that eligibility for financial aid and the amount of financial aid could be slightly different every year. So they require annual applications. The Master Promissory Note is the other document that needs to be done, and it is used for all federal student loans, particularly for the Stafford loan and the Perkins loan. Used to have to fill out a separate promissory note each year as well, but the Master Promissory Note allows students to essentially have one promissory note that is good for up to 10 years, and the only reason they would have to fill out a new promissory note is if they change schools. For those of you who have not completed a FAFSA recently, my son and I just went through that fun process the first week in January, so it's near and dear to my heart. There is a demonstration website, and this is the information on how to get to the website. If you go there just to see, because you hear a lot of people talk about how daunting the FAFSA process is. The paper form is very daunting. The online form is less so because it has a lot of skip logic built into it. So if it's a question that really isn't relevant to your situation, you never see it. So you don't end up answering questions that you don't need to answer. The underscore in red there is the URL for the website. Username, password. When you get to that website, it gives you a couple of tables that have sample student names, incomes, social security numbers, so that you can use one of those kind of pretend student records to create a FAFSA. to go through the FAFSA process in the demo site and see exactly what it looks like. This particular slide, and it, at least you can see it on the screen in the handout, it's pretty tiny. This is a screenshot that I made from last year's demo, FAFSA demo, and it looks the same this year. You see on the right, you have the helpful hints column, which doesn't exist on the paper form, and the earlier versions of the online FAFSA were nothing like this. It's much, much better. But if you see under student eligibility that question, when you begin college in 13-14, what will be your high school completion status? Here are your four responses. High school diploma, GED certificate, homeschooled, none of the above. Based on that language, I'm willing to bet that most students that have a modified diploma or an extended diploma answer high school diploma. Because there's nothing in the definition that says only an official standard regular high school diploma. And what happens is when some of these students are later down the road, maybe selected for verification where the school is required by the U.S. Department of Education to verify certain data elements that are provided on the FAFSA, if they ask for the high school diploma and they recognize the fact that the student has a modified diploma, then they have to undo all of the financial aid that's the federal financial aid that's been offered for that student. And I had the experience in summer of 2012, a student who had been accepted to Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C., and his mother called, and I think it was in June of 2012. She called, "We just found out that because my son has a modified diploma, he's lost all of his Pell Grant and his student loans, and I don't think we can pay for Gallaudet. He's going to have to go to school in Oregon." Ultimately, he did lose. He lost all of his federal aid. All he had left was the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and he ended up going to a community college in Oregon. But we had a very upset parent in tears. I mean, actually, we had two parents the same week with the same situation who called us. But how would they know based on the way the language is worded on the FAFSA? So I think,
even if they withdrew from school for the last semester and homeschooled for the last semester, could they then mark homeschool? And
you know, Representative Gelser, that's a very good, that's a very good question. I don't know why you wouldn't be able to. I mean, it's one of those technicalities. You do, you don't, you can, you can't, you. And technically, all of these students should answer none of the above, unless you believe that a high school diploma, regardless of whether it's modified, extended, or regular, is a high school diploma. The problem is that you can find out everything gets undone down the road unless some adjustments are made. So I think this is where counseling with students really comes into play. Probably early on, to help parents understand what this might mean down the road if the student truly could go to college and has the academic capabilities of going to college. You need to really think carefully about what do we do and how do we do it, and what kind of information do we give them, and how early in the game.
So did I understand you correctly that if you have a modified or extended and you check high school diploma, that mm-hmm. there's a sampling process?
No.
That does it? Or is everybody checked?
So. Not everybody is checked. It's a sampling process.
So yeah. If you checked it incorrectly, but you weren't part of the sample, could later on?
It's possible.
Could you be required to pay it back?
Yes,
that?
You could be required to pay it
so
back.
Somewhere after you graduated, for example.
After you graduated, I think it's too late.
Okay.
It's too late. But if you were, and what will happen sometimes in the verification process for financial aid is it might not be the first iteration of the FAFSA that is selected for more sort of more detailed review. If you updated an address or added another school to the FAFSA, maybe it's the third or fourth iteration that suddenly you're selected for verification, then at that point, it could be a couple of terms down the road, and they may have to ask for you to pay the money back in the middle of the school year.
But the bottom line is some people could be subject to that. Other people may not.
That's true.
Based on circumstance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Kind of random. Here, these are the state private aid programs that our agency administers, the Oregon Opportunity Grant, student child care, the scholarship for children of deceased or disabled public safety officers. We do administer one federal program, the federal CHAFE education training voucher program. This one is a little bit different because what we have found out from DHS is that some of the CHAFE students also have modified diplomas. And they are eligible for CHAFE because it's a completely different program, but may not be eligible for Pell or Stafford loans. And they are eligible for the Oregon Opportunity Grant. So,
and CHAFE has to do with foster youth?
Yes. CHAFE is, yes. Yes, Senator. Yeah, it is for former foster youth. We also administer some private scholarships at our agency. Actually, we're up to a little over 480 individual private scholarship programs right now. And there are also institutional grants and scholarships. What that means is that individual colleges, many colleges, especially larger ones, have private foundations, and it may be a departmental award or scholarship, and it might be a private foundation scholarship for a particular group of targeted students. And those would also not necessarily be at risk because they don't have to follow federal eligibility criteria. They're the criteria established by the college or by the donor at that college. You also have loans, private loans. Many private loans have higher interest rates and different kinds of repayment options. Institutional loans, sometimes colleges also have small loans that they offer their students. They're usually sort of short-term or emergency loans. And then you also have, of course, the proverbial rich uncle or grandmother or other sort of private family gift aid. For the OSAC programs, we also have a couple of applications that are required. Oregon Opportunity Grant, the FAFSA is the application. That's it. So we use exactly the same data as the Department of Education uses for the federal Pell Grant program and for federal Stafford loans. We have a couple of other programs for the scholarships that we help administer. We and you see right there it says more than 470. It's now up to 480. The OSAC application is a separate online application that's on the OSAC website. And just as a plug, the early bird deadline for the OSAC application is February 15th, which is Saturday. And the ultimate final no later than deadline for the OSAC application this year is March 1st. So if you happen to have college-age kids that you want to kind of push in that direction, that's where you go. The CHAFE program, child care, and DDPSO all have separate applications as well. And these are the eligibility criteria for the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Like I said, they're essentially the same as for the federal Pell Grant. The only difference is the Oregon residency. Students have to have been residents of the state of Oregon for at least 12 months before the period of enrollment. We do have a waiver for students who are members of certain out-of-state tribes that have traditional ties to the state of Oregon. And in some cases, if parents relocate to Oregon, dad's job moves him from, I don't know, from Nebraska to Oregon, and the child comes with, the child's residency is based upon the parents' residency. So a child whose parents have just relocated would be considered eligible for the Oregon Opportunity. Likewise, if the student has parents who have been residents of Oregon for at least 12 months, but then the parent leaves Oregon for a job someplace else and the student remains in Oregon and is continuously enrolled, that student maintains eligibility for the opportunity grant. And these are the conditions of award. The grant's available for up to 4 years, subject to verification, satisfactory academic progress. Most of these are the same as for the federal Pell Grant program. I put this slide in here just so you have a vague idea of how we calculate what an award amount looks like, but the next slide makes more sense probably because it has real numbers. If you have a full need student, this is the average cost of attendance at an Oregon public four-year university and for a community college. We collect all of that information from financial aid officers, and then we calculate averages of tuition and fees, and then averages across all types of schools for the non-tuition costs, which is books and fees, living expenses, transportation, and so on. So this is the way it's calculated, and you will see down at the bottom below those red arrows should have moved up, and they didn't. You'll see two calculations in there, the remaining need calculation and the Oregon award maximum. And you'll see that there's a rather large difference between remaining need, which for a public four-year is $6,265, and $2,000, which is the current maximum award amount for the opportunity grant. We have many more students eligible for the grant than we have money, and it's difficult. If you look at either of those formulas and you see that line right in the middle of the screen, the Pell amount for $5,645, if you crossed that out, that is essentially what happens to the financial aid calculation for a student with a modified or extended diploma right now. $5,600, or right now $5,700, drops out. So it increases the remaining need by a rather large amount of money. And here are a couple of federal policies that affect the calculation for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, which is currently now almost the only financial aid that a lot of students with modified diplomas are eligible to receive. Timing of the federal budget process, because the formula includes the federal Pell Grants. So if Congress does or does not increase funding for the federal Pell Grant program, that can affect what happens to the formula for the opportunity grant. If there are changes to the FAFSA, if there are changes to federal need analysis that calculate based on income how many people are eligible for a zero expected family contribution or for a very high need, low income grant eligibility, that can happen as well. I mean, right now, under federal need analysis, a family income of, I think it's $30,000 or less, the student would be considered eligible for a zero expected family contribution. But, you know, it has been higher and it has been lower, and Congress has changed that. So that can be a surprise, especially since Congress doesn't necessarily look at the calendar for the academic year. So those numbers could change in May. And then everyone has to go back and recalculate everything. So that can be a problem. Federal higher education tax credits, those amounts have not changed in 4 or 5 years now, and there continues to be talk about whether those tax credits will continue or not. And then you have the budget bills and the timing of budget bills. And we have the reauthorization of the Higher Education Act, which is scheduled to start, I believe, in 2015. But it took Congress an extra 2 or 3 years the last time they reauthorized it, so it could be a while. Okay, this is a summary of the aid issues with students who have modified or extended diplomas. We have the 2009 Department of Education determination that a modified diploma does not meet eligibility criteria for federal student aid, the elimination of the ability to benefit test as an option. These are the types of federal funds that are lost. Compounded with that, because the Opportunity Grant Program is severely underfunded at the moment, there are far more eligible students than we can possibly serve, we have an extremely early application deadline. We have the earliest application deadline in the country, unfortunately. And so students have to be right on top of things in order to be able to even qualify for the grant at this point. And that's it.
Are there questions for Susan?
I have one question.
Sure.
Can a student become eligible for both the Pell Grant and the SEOG?
Yes. In fact, the Pell Grant is a criterion for eligibility for the FSEOG.
So they could get up to almost $10,000 if they...
They could. The highest need students are the only ones who would qualify. The way that FSEOG funds are awarded, schools are required to award the highest need students first and then work down, and usually they don't get very far down the list.
Senator Dimbrough.
Thanks. going back to the issue of the former foster youth,
mm-hmm.
You know, a few years ago we passed the Foster Youth Promise Bill,
mm-hmm.
which is intended to allow former foster youth to go to college or university tuition-free,
mm-hmm.
As long as they meet certain mm-hmm. you know, criteria. And the thinking behind that, and when we costed it out, it was based on the methodology of last dollar. So the commitment from the state was, after Pell Grant was considered and Oregon Opportunity Grant and, after those two were considered, anything that was left over, the state would pick that up via the community colleges or universities. So, I'm wondering, at the time we hadn't talked about the problem of perhaps there are a number of students who, you know, for whom there's no Pell Grant, and has this come up at all as an issue in terms of the colleges or universities complaining about, because actually, as I recall, it's actually the colleges and universities that are on the hook for it.
Yes. Senator Dimbrough, you're right. They are the ones who are on the hook for waiving the tuition and fees. And honestly, when the former foster youth bill and the prioritized Oregon Opportunity Grant portion of that, when that passed, nobody knew. The decision that Congress made to eliminate the ability to benefit process happened after the bill was passed. So I think maybe the language in the bill, and I can't remember the bill number, would probably have been different had we known that Pell eligibility and student loan eligibility would not be available for those students. So it's something that I think is new, and I'm not quite sure. I would have to talk with my colleagues, the financial aid directors, and find out how many of them are dealing with this as an issue. I do remember that the DHS people were concerned about students with modified diplomas and what this might do. And this was before we were talking about these issues with the ability to benefit test. So I will check with my colleagues.
Yeah, you don't need to make a lot of noise around.
Sure.
This, Susan.
Yeah. I'll ask a couple of key people that trusted friends. How's that?
So Susan, at the very beginning, you said that the statute doesn't define high school diploma. So that is a definition that's determined by the Assistant Secretary or by the U.S. Department of Ed.
You know, Representative Gelser, I cannot remember if there is a definition. I will have to go back and look. There may be something in regulation. It's not in statute. But I don't know how the regulation reads. But I will get the regulation for you.
So, and are we allowed to ask Sarah a question? Can we ask Drinkwater a question?
Pardon?
Are we allowed to ask Sarah Drinkwater a question?
Oh, sure. She just needs to come up to a mic and identify herself.
Sorry.
Sarah. So this is Sarah Drinkwater, who is in charge of special ed. So in the clarification letter that Susan mentioned, was that, did ODE write to the U.S. Department of Ed and say, do our modified diplomas count, or did they write and say, please consider our modified diplomas because this is the rigor that we put into our modified diplomas, these are the credits. Is that something we could try?
This is Sarah Drinkwater, just so for the record, from the Oregon Department of Education. And the letter that was written was prior to my even living in the state of Oregon. So I'm looking at Sally because I know she was working in high schools at that time and was very involved in that. We know that the information that came back from the U.S. Department of Education was that the modified diploma, but how it was worded on our end, I don't know.
And I don't know that either. It was before I started my job here, but and I've seen one copy of that letter that someone had, but it was just that they asked the Department of Ed clarification around the modified diploma, and they got back that our modified diploma didn't meet those standards.
Wasn't very helpful, but we can go back and take a look at the letter.
I can get a copy of that letter and send it.
Yeah, because it seems like there's a difference between asking for clarification, or if we worked with our federal delegation to send a request and kind of lay out, this is how closely our modified diploma tracks, and it's not just something we're handing out. Kids have to go through this whole series of things, and if the definition isn't in statute, maybe we could get a regulation change or a letter that would.
And I think there are very two good places to look, Susan. You know, with the looking in the regulations to see if there is a definition somewhere, and then how was the request constructed. How long ago
was that?
How long ago? It was probably late 2011.
I think it's in 11 that the letter was written for clarification.
2009.
Oh, 2009, even way before.
Yeah.
I think it was the first year that the modified diplomas were awarded, because there was the question about military and...
Okay. So, yeah, even longer ago than I realized. Mm-hmm.
I guess the ability to benefit maybe was 12. Mm-hmm. It came out in 12, so that was a part of that.
Oh, the ability to benefit was in 2012.
Oh.
Thank you, Sarah.
Oh, sure.
Any further questions for Susan? Nope. Thank you. Okay, so next we're back to Clint again for a reprise on maybe not as rushed on the youth transition programs as a model.
Thank you. And I'm just going to stay where I am because I don't have a PowerPoint. So
you're perfect.
So I'm Clint DeLongpre with Vocational Rehabilitation. And last task force meeting, I handed out a couple of documents, this one, which is up there, and also a booklet on the service providers, international service providers for people with disabilities, who had rated the Oregon YTP program as one of the top 10 best practices programs in the world. So we're very proud of that. If anyone is unfamiliar with what vocational rehabilitation does, we assist people with disabilities in obtaining successful employment, and there's no age requirements for that. It can be a student up to, you know, I have a client on my caseload that's 72 right now. Oregon VR has had a successful youth transition program in place for over 20 years, and I'll refer to it as VR or Voc Rehab because vocational rehabilitation gets me tongue-tied if I say it too many times. Oregon YTP, as a best practices program, best practices is considered a method or a technique that has consistently shown results superior to those achieved with other means. So I kind of want to offer up Oregon YTP as a proven model for working with students with disabilities that are transitioning from high school. Now, I do need to add that Oregon VR and all VR programs are pretty much focused on employment, but we do support higher education if we feel that it's necessary to get a student to the job goal that they've chosen that we can support.
And so let me speak briefly on how VR deals with higher education. First off, we don't have any requirements that a client has a regular diploma, modified diploma, certificate of attendance, any of those things. Basically, if they have a job goal and it requires higher education, then we will consider helping them with that if we feel that it's necessary for them to get to that job goal. The way Voc Rehab works with higher education is generally we only support up to two-year degrees or certificate programs because, again, our focus is training leading directly to a job. And how we work with the unmet needs is that we require our students to apply for financial aid, the Pell Grant, and they have to apply before the deadline, the March 1st deadline. But they don't have to be eligible for it. They just have to show that they've applied, and then we have to look at the results. And if they're not eligible and we are going to help them with college, then we will cover what are called unmet needs. And Voc Rehab considers unmet needs only those needs related to tuition, books, and fees, and will also help with transportation costs. And we have a form that we send to the college, the financial aid office. They fill it out and return it to us, and they give estimates for the academic year of, you know, how much the student will be paying for tuition, books, fees, transportation. They also include personal expenses, and there's another category that I can't remember right offhand. But we can only look at the unmet needs related to tuition, books, and fees, and then we have to also go by their estimate on transportation costs, because if we go above that, they figure that into the financial aid, and so we can't double dip, basically. So, you know, we're more than happy to help students get higher education, and we don't require a regular diploma. Generally, if we're unsure that the student is going to be successful in college, we don't want to set them up for failure. So we will do an assessment term often, and we'll cover the whole cost of assessment terms, even if they're eligible for financial aid, because if they don't successfully complete the assessment term, then we can no longer assist them with higher education. And the assessment term, they have to take at least 12 credits, and they have to maintain a GPA of at least 2.0 or above to be considered a successful assessment term. Any student with a disability can apply for Oregon VR. Those that are in a school that's opted into the youth transition program seem to have a better success rate than those that are not in a school that has the YTP program. And I believe that's because Oregon VR provides lots of supports that aren't available to students that aren't in VR and that aren't in a YTP program. Oregon YTP is a collaborative effort between Oregon Voc Rehab, Oregon Department of Education, and the University of Oregon. And at that point, I want to give you some statistics about our program. This biennium report is from July 1st, 2011 through June 30th of 2013. During that time period, we had 1,447 students apply for VR services through a YTP high school. 73% of those applicants moved into an individualized plan for employment. That's part of the process of us helping with anything towards employment, is they have to be in a plan. As far as applicant characteristics, they were mostly male, 62%, and mostly white, 79%. The vast majority of them, 48%, had a primary disability of a specific learning disability. 13% had other health impairments, which would be a physical disability. 11% had an intellectual disability. 11% were on the autism spectrum, and 7% had either an emotional or behavioral disorder. 61% had no prior work experience at application. 48% were living in poverty at application. 19% were engaged in community activities. 27% had good communication skills. 38% had a supportive network of friends and family. 43% had a positive approach to their disability. And 49% were active and motivated in school. And because this is a grant process, and I'll get more into that in just a moment, of course, there are benchmarks that have to be met for the grant to be successful. So we have a benchmark called engagement, and engagement is considered that at the exit of the program, the student has to be either employed, enrolled in post-secondary education, or some combination of the two. So during that biennium period, 80% of our students were engaged at exit, 80% were still engaged at 6 months after exit, and 79% were still engaged at 12 months after exit. So they were still either working or in higher education or some combination of the two. Wages and number of hours worked per week increased for students that were employed at the 6-month and 12-month follow-ups. Students who were still employed at 12 months were earning an average wage of $9.80, which was almost a dollar more per hour than the Oregon minimum wage at that time. And they were working an average of 29 hours per week. And during that biennium period, 53% of the clients, the YTP students, were closed as a success. And to have a successful closure, they have to have been employed for at least 90 days, and then they're closed as a success. And this is on the website, and you should all have handouts of it, too. So a little bit more about the funding structure for the YTP program in Oregon. It's a competitive grant process, and it's funded on a biennial schedule. So every 2 years, we request grant proposals from school districts and educational service districts across the state. The proposals need to provide a budget for the YTP program on site for 2 years. A team reviews those and ranks those grant proposals, and the highest rated grant proposals are the ones that are funded. The grant is a one-third match grant. So, for example, if a district proposes a total budget for the YTP program for 2 years of $180,000, then they need to match a third of that, so $60,000 from general funds, and the other two-thirds of that are provided by Voc Rehab. So, pretty good deal. And right now, YTP is in about 85 districts across the state, and we have a budget right now of approximately $9 million. And I'd like to end this with a success story, which kind of gives an example of how Voc Rehab can assist a student who's dealing with these kind of issues, like having a modified diploma or needing to get a GED. So I'm going to call my student Joe, and I'm calling this story Joe and the GED. So last year I had a referral of a student through the YTP program for VR services, and Joe had just discovered, he was in his senior year and discovered that he was going to be a super senior because he had about 2 years to go before he had enough credits to graduate with a regular diploma. And so, unfortunately, Joe decided to drop out of high school. And Joe came to me with limited documentation. So I went ahead and authorized a learning disabilities evaluation, and that's what made Joe eligible for our services, his severe ADHD and a mathematics disorder. Okay. During the process, Joe decided that he would like to get his GED. And so we set him up with GED classes through Chemeketa. And he went through some classes during the spring term, and then he went through the summer term, accessed the tutors, took the GED test, passed all the portions except, of course, the math portion because he has a mathematics disorder. And my concern for Joe at the time was that I knew that there were going to be big changes coming to the GED process as of the first of the year this year. So I really encouraged him, you know, to do his best to pass his GED before the first of the year. So we hired a private tutor for Joe, a math tutor, and he worked intensively with Joe through the fall. And I'm happy to report that Joe got his GED mid-December. So that's how Voc Rehab can help with these issues. So. Anybody have any questions?
Any questions for Clint? So any school district can go through your grant process to
any,
apply?
Any school district, educational service district can apply for Voc Rehab YTP program. Yeah.
Representative Demarest. Senator
Demarest. Clint, why do you think the demographics are as they are in the program? So many more young men and people not of color? I wonder how that syncs up with the general population of students with IEPs, for example.
Senator Denbrough, I don't know how to answer that question. I don't know. Yeah, something else that we don't track is whether they graduated with a modified or regular diploma. And hopefully now that I've asked about that, they'll start tracking that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they, to what extent do they self-refer into the program and... that referral process, I wonder if that has something to do with the demographics of the...
Well, the YTP specialist in the school generally refers the students to Voc Rehab, and because it is a grant and because there are limited funds available, Generally, only those students who appear to be motivated and able to benefit from the program are referred. So that might have some impact on who actually gets referred. But any student can apply. They don't have to be referred through the YTP program.
Other questions? Thank you very much. So next up, following up on the conversation last week about transcripts, we have Joel from the Department of Ed. And Jan, do you want to come too? Or?
Well, there's just one chair.
Okay.
We have plenty of chairs, Jan.
We were hoping you could talk with, last month we had a really series of great presentations about some challenges with transcripting and a lot of difference from district to district and the challenge of knowing what a kid has done when they come to a district because of the way transcripts are, and we had hoped the department could come and talk about how the department might be able to aid in creating some more uniformity across the state around transcripting.
Well, one of the things that I didn't know exactly what I was going to be asked for, so I put together a presentation. But one of the things that you'll find is that the department can help with that, but that is more of a national thing. We have the P20W Electronic Standards Council helps define transcripts and that. And then you have, like, the National Center for Education Statistics helps define course codes and things like that. So, you know, there's certain places where that is defined. You can also, there are, like on the IB and AP courses, you'll get there's a code that relates to that. I know that some districts are putting like an M in front of their subject area when they do the transcript. So when the student's transcript comes across, they'll have an M for modified. So, and it isn't the same for every information system. I did get some example transcripts from three different information systems here, and though only one of them shows a modified transcript, and that's on page, excuse me, I think it's towards the back. And yes, on page 8 and 9, there's an extended diploma on page 8, and on page 9, there's a modified diploma. The changes, the extended, of course, doesn't, I think it's 12 credits to get an extended and 24 for a modified with specific courses, but there isn't anything that I know of that requires a school district or school to identify a modified course or not. And they try to limit the amount of space that they're using because they don't, you know, they're looking at little things like paper and printing as the cost of that. So they try to get it to one page if they can't. So they don't want to put a lot of information on here. But like I said, if you look on the modified, there's a subject area, and you'll see LA, MA, and that's the graduation area for the, and this is on page 9. That's the graduation area, relates to the graduation area. So some places will add a code to that, putting an M in front of that. So the LA stands for language arts, whereas you put an M in front of that and it's modified language arts. That's one way that it's done.
And I guess the question that we had, because we had a great presentation last month and people did a really great job of bringing in different transcripts for different kinds of credits. And I think what was clear at that point was that there isn't a statewide requirement around putting an M or an MA, and different places talked about putting different things there. And there might be a kid that's getting a regular diploma, not a modified diploma, that might have a modified credit. Right. So what we'd asked the department to come and talk about was what kind of leadership the department could provide in terms of helping districts come up with a uniform way of transcripting what a student has actually done in class, whether it was a modified credit or not a modified credit, so when a student moves from one part of the state to another. So we kind of had the presentation about what the transcripts okay. look like and that there's nothing required, but we were hoping the department could provide us some guidance with where do we go next? It's a problem. How do we fix it?
Well, one of the things we would do is work with the districts. We have what's called the Data Collection Committee, and we would talk to those district personnel and about defining some sort of a standard. And that's one place where we work with districts. The department could do. I mean, if it's decided that the department should do that, then the department would, go about saying that this is the defined method for identifying modified class courses. I'm not the one, I'm in the tech side, so I'm not the one that would decide that. It would probably be more down in the Office of Learning or something like that, that how that would be decided. But if they decide on a specific methodology, it would mean that everyone's student information system would have to be adjusted to deal with that. It would mean that all of the reports that are made, these are reports, would have to be adjusted and all that too. So they'd have to work with their vendors, and it would take some time. But just like anything else that we do, we give them a year's notice about a change that's coming, and then that change goes into effect. And we can do that. It's just a matter of making a decision as to how it's going to be done. I'm not sure I'm answering your question, sorry.
Well, no, thank you. So Jan, what would a good next step be in terms of how do we have that conversation about influencing the decision to do that, or which part of the department we should talk to, kind of based on the presentation we had last month? How do we go to that next step of having a conversation about coordination through the department? Because it seems like that's a better department thing than having a law that tells districts how to put things on a transcript.
So Chair Gelser, members of the task force, I'd have to take this back to like our management team and talk about Jan McComb with the Department of Education, what this would involve and whether we would need to hear from districts and put together our own internal work group, or we would propose an administrative rule. And an administrative rule has, a hearing process. We get public input, things like that. Right now, we don't have any administrative rules on transcripts. And we have up in on the tech side, we have manuals on how to do things for districts, but they're not really reflected in rules. And so we would have to try to look at both of those aspects of this and see how best to proceed. We'd probably want to get some input from districts, though, for sure. I don't want to say the word work group, but we might want to pull some folks together to see how this could best be done.
I'm sorry, Chair Gelser. I'm sorry. I didn't notify you of myself, my name at the beginning of the protocol. Sorry about this. I'm Joel Robe, Director of Data Management at ODE. But I did want to say something that this can't be a voluntary type of thing. It has to be defined somewhere, if it's rule or something, because not everybody will do it. And, you have these really small districts that aren't using a student information system, and they're using spreadsheets and stuff, so they would have to be, they may not do it as easily as somebody that's using a student information system that can have the vendor change it. So
we would just want to explore and make sure that we don't do something inadvertent or have unintended consequences. So we'd want to vet it.
Yeah. Are there other folks that have questions for the department?
Yeah. I don't know if it's a question or a comment, but I think just looking at districts and the information dissemination, that I think districts are starting to catch on and put different things on their transcripts, but it's taking a long time because when the laws change and then it goes to, I mean, it just takes a long time to get to the school level where the course catalog is. And then, I mean, it took me 3 weeks in my district to ask for, please, at the district level, create a course that has a star or an M or whatever, because we're all so shorthanded that it just, yep, it'll be in the pile. So I think districts are starting to recognize they need to do it. But it's just one of those things that it's in the pile of to-dos, you know. And I know that at my school, we all of our students that are getting modified credits have it on their transcript. But that is new this year because I just kept pushing. Where's my course catalog? Where's my course catalog? It was a weekly, you know, asking that data person because I don't have control over my course catalog in my school. But I know, you know, it's starting to come. And so I wonder if it's just that we're behind.
And I was just going to add to what Raina said is that we are having the same issue at our school. I mean, people are getting the information. Our administration knows it's there. They know they need to address it, and they know they need to have conversations about it. It's just, how do we go about having those conversations? Who do we go to? How do we get the information out there to the teachers and to the students and parents and so on?
And another thing you need to remember is that if we put this on a transcript and you send it out of state, then they're going to wonder what that means. And so that's going to generate a phone call back and stuff like that. So the idea is to maybe start to think about this on a wider scale, like, you know, work with Washington, California, Idaho, that sort of a thing, too, or possibly even on a national level, to identify a code or a system of codes that define, you know, modified, extended, whatever type of course that you want. So.
Just, I wasn't sure I heard something correctly. So did I hear that there is no uniform standard for transcripts in general?
That's pretty much correct. I mean, these are all fairly similar because you have the same kind of information on it, but there are optional pieces of information. Because the schools are trying to get their students accepted for admission, higher ed is who drives what's on these. Because you want to have things like, you know, some of this is optional, like activities that they're involved in, but the school wants that on there, so they'll have that added. And sometimes they have to go to their vendor and say, well, you'll have to change your transcript to meet our needs and, you know, whatever that cost is and do that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions? Representative Embro. Senator Embro.
Yeah, I didn't even notice. the genesis of the task force was one of the concerns that was raised, that led to the creation of legislation that was raised in the hearings, challenges people are having because of inconsistencies in transcripts.
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Just literally what the piece of paper looks like, but more importantly, what it means. If some districts will just put modified diploma on the transcript, and you can't, does that mean every single class has been modified? Does it mean just one? Which to me is really crucial, especially as we're looking at that group of kids who really just have a single subject learning challenge, whereas all of their courses except math are regular. And once modified diploma, the way a lot of transcripts I've seen is put down, it just really pretty much implies everything has been modified. We have a group of kids caught in the middle where we started labeling modified classes and then put them on a modified diploma and stop doing that. So it looks like all of a sudden they had a real growth spurt. and so what happened? And so it's tough. Is there any talk about having the state have one
standard
vendor? And so they look the same? Because it's not just a coding thing. It's a kind of craziness in format.
There has been talk about that. There's the cost to go that route is very high. So I know that the OEIB recently did a study. It's a business case that's coming before the legislature, I think next week or something like that, to determine whether that was feasible or finding an alternative, and they went with the alternative as in their summary because of the, I think the cost was in the, you know, $50-60 million to change everybody over from their existing systems to a new system and that. So yes, there's also some political fighting that would have to take place because some of those folks have been with their systems for a long time.
I think the other issue that came up last month was the idea of a modified diploma in Oregon isn't that it's a modified diploma track. It's that you identify that a student is eligible at a certain point in high school, but they're always supposed to be working towards that regular diploma. And if the transcript where the student is checking how they're progressing towards graduation is based on a modified diploma, and then their counseling team sits with them and says, look how close you are, all of a sudden the whole thing shifts because they're both 24 credits, but if you have a couple of modified credits and you switch it to a regular diploma, all of a sudden you're 10 credits short instead of 2 credits short because you have a couple of them that are modified, which can be pretty disheartening to the student. And on the flip side, if you just see the modified diploma and you can't see on the transcript, gosh, I'm only a math credit away from a standard diploma, maybe I should come back in the summer or do an online class or whatever, it's not there. And then the third issue that people talked about that stuck with me this month was a student moves, and I appreciate the idea of a nationwide thing where we could all understand what we're doing, but if a kid moves from Matt's district to Pendleton and Pendleton can't figure out what the kid has done and gives them a regular diploma, even though every credit they've had is a modified credit, that doesn't make any sense either. So it would be great if just in Oregon kids could know what they had done and other high schools could know what they'd done by adding a letter M.
Or something, or some standard, you know, that would be. One of the things is that there are federal codes that identify different courses and what subject areas they meet, and it would be nice if those were defined for modified courses too, but I was looking and I didn't see anything, so they get stuck under what's called other, unfortunately. And so that would be nice at the federal level if they would set those codes, because that's what allows folks to go from any state to any state. And so,
Senator Edwards.
Thank you. So, Joel, did I hear you correctly that you would not need legislative authority to write some rules to standardize things, or you would need legislative authority to specify what the goals of those rules would be?
Yeah, Senator Edwards, I'm probably not the one to say that. I would think that an administrative rule would be enough, though, because I think that's enough for our districts to say, okay, then we've got to change things, and then we with the ODE would push that to the districts and say, this is what's going to happen now. So.
Thank you very much.
Do you know, has the state board weighed in on this issue at all of consistency of transcripts?
Chair Gilser, Senator Dembro, no, it has not.
That may also be a good place to start, just to have a sort of opportunity for public input on this issue, you know, et cetera. And then, I mean, if we have to do legislation, it may well be something for us to look at, especially if the colleges are having problems, for example, in the universities because of inconsistencies in the transcripts. They may have an interest in that. But, you know, also it just really strikes me, especially given what we heard from Susan, that the question of the penalty, potential penalty of the modified diploma is really, I think it's a real issue. And it's something that really needs to be looked at.
Senator Mike,
Somebody one time told me that a problem well defined is a problem half solved, and I'm wondering, right, from a task from the as a task for the task force is to take, I think, the comments that Representative Gelsinger, you were just making, and frame it in a way that this is really what we're trying to accomplish, you know, as a result of the request to the department. You know, that is, sounds, again, this is far from my field, but that it sounds like it is an issue between the among the regular or modified diploma. Number one, that's kind of the scope we're talking about, and that it's really, we're looking at this from a student experience perspective, and that it's to come up with a way to identify the modified classes that can be easily support going from one district to another, and support the planning from that student and family's perspective in terms of, I think, the framework that you were just talking about, because there are opportunities one way or discussions the other, depending on what that looks like. I mean, I'm kind of rambling, but I think if we could maybe come up with a statement that we could say this is what we're trying and to accomplish and the public trying to solve, so we know it. Just a suggestion.
So, Jan, if we came up with a statement like that, that encapsulated that, and then said department in a bill that maybe came off the Senate floor today with a relating to ed clause, department go work with districts to have standard notations on transcripts, would that have a giant fiscal on it?
Well, Chair Gelser, we'd have to stop and calculate, you know, how many meetings we would have to have. We'd want higher ed at the table. We'd want school districts. We'd want some folks who've already sort of pioneered this, and if there's anything we can steal and use, you know, what you've already done, you know, that would be great.
We'd have to change the transcripts and work with their vendors.
Well, that would be actually doing it. The legislation would just tell us to go forth and propose something. To actually implement change transcripts, we would have to probably reach out and try to figure out how much that would cost. That probably would be a huge fiscal to actually say, thou shalt do that.
That's biennial.
What? Right, right. You said not the next biennial. But what?
Plan B.
Is there a timing issue, though, in terms of the development of the longitudinal student data system? I mean, are we developing data systems right now where it would be more cost-effective to look at the way we're compiling student information and keeping track of it over time? I mean, does that dovetail with that at all, or is this a completely different system?
This would be different, because the longitudinal data system pulls the data from the student information system, and the student information system is where the transcript is created. So the longitudinal data system is a reporting system more than it is a transactional system, what we call a transactional system.
But if we did a longitudinal system that pulled data from a system, from the student system, and then later we changed the system, could there be a, not that we ever have technological incompatibilities in government, but could there be a problem with those systems talking to each other if we build one based on the existing systems and then changed it?
No, we can update the longitudinal data system to incorporate the new changes. Yeah. Do that.
Did I hear you say that you could do that at any time, just for clarification?
Right. It's, you know, I mean, we're going to have some time, but, you know, it's not going to be something we can do 1 week to the next, but given a year or something like that, or even 6 months, probably we could do something like that and get that all incorporated. It's just an identifier for the course, so it's not a huge thing.
Any other questions for the department on this one? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And then next we've got Sarah and Danielle to talk about, I've lost my agenda, to talk about highly qualified teachers and the impact on credit.
We can go over there. Sarah, do you want to come on up?
Sure.
Thanks.
PowerPoint, and then I'll do that.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Representative Gelser, I'm Danielle Sheldrake from the Beaverton School District, and I've actually brought two additional people with me, and they can go ahead and introduce themselves.
I'm Rome Brasky. I'm an ALC teacher at Aloha High School.
Hi, I'm Christy Bassel. I'm an assistant principal at Sunset High School.
So we're here today. I'm going to kind of talk about the district perspective of recent highly qualified information that the district received around our special education teachers who teach specialized program classes. And to explain what a specialized program is, it's what some districts may call a self-contained program. However, our students are not self-contained when they're placed in that program. Many of them take one, two, or three classes within, like, Rome's Academic Learning Center, ALC program, but then they're out of that program for other courses. And so really the inclusion in a class where Rome is teaching it all is very student specific. So I'll talk a little bit about the discussion I've been having with building principals and our model around that has been impacted based on the highly qualified information we've received from the department. Christy is going to speak a little bit about what it looks like at the building level, and then Rome talking about the impact at the classroom level, student level, because I wanted to give a broad perspective of what this looks like. So just in terms of history, last year, Beaverton in particular, we were identified as not being fully highly qualified. We didn't have highly qualified special education teachers teaching particularly high school special ed classes that might be core content. And when we talk about core content, we're talking about English, math, science, and social studies. And we had been informed that in order to address the highly qualified issue at the high school level, the special education teacher needed to pass a multiple subject test called the ARELA or get K-8 certification. All of our teachers did that. They met the HQ requirements. We thought we were good to go until September, when we were notified that for those high school teachers who were teaching in our specialized programs that might be delivering core content to students who are working towards a modified diploma or extended diploma, so not a standard diploma, that those teachers now also needed to be single subject content highly qualified, which meant they needed to go out and either get an endorsement in English or math at the science or social studies at the high school level, or pass a competency exam like the Praxis, which is an example of one of the assessments. So that impacts all of our academic learning center teachers in our district at our five comprehensive high schools. And that's approximately 10 teachers who have now been identified as not meeting highly qualified standards for delivering core content at the high school to students, once again, on modified, receiving a modified diploma or extended diploma. So what that meant is we had to have a conversation about how the district was going to address that. And so I met with building principals and assistant principals who work with special ed to look at all the options we could consider as a district. And what you have is a document that kind of looks at, well, it looks like you're missing a page, a middle page here. So I don't know if I can, is it possible to pull that up? It's like the second page. But what you have are seven options that we considered. And none of them are, they're not in order of preference, but I wanted to put every option out on the table so we could have a conversation as a district around that. And some of those options included full inclusion. So taking a student who is currently in a special education program, so full inclusion is option number one, and saying they're going to take all their core content courses in the general ed setting. Now, what I want to be clear is we are strongly supportive of full, you know, including students with disabilities in the general ed setting. However, we are driven by the IEP process and have a continuum of placement options for students. So the IEP team, along with the parent, makes a recommendation about what that placement is. So to now change our model and say all students who are on track or working towards a modified or extended diploma now need to take those courses by a general ed teacher, possibly in the general ed setting,
would require an IEP meeting and having a conversation about what that looks like. And we talked about different options around that, about placing the student in the general ed setting, possibly pushing the ALC teacher in co-teaching. You can run a co-teaching model. You could completely do without the ALC teacher and just say, we're going to fund core content teachers. We looked at a couple of those options and what would that look like. However, in many of those options, the conversation came back to, well, we have a free appropriate public education FAPE responsibility for the student, and now are we saying this removal may no longer be an option for that student, or do they need to consider an alternative certificate because their special ed teacher doesn't meet core competency in English language arts, science, math, and social studies? So that was one option we looked at. I'm going to change to the second page. You got that? Another option, so we have the co-teaching. Another was looking at, like I said, reducing special education teacher time and saying, okay, we're going to reduce our special education teacher time to purchase a general ed teacher time to teach the courses that the students require. But implications to that is that the general ed teacher may not have the skills or the necessary tools to work with some of the students in our academic learning center population, but that was an option. Another was to look at reducing certified teacher time and looking at adding classified instructional assistants to push in to the general ed setting. So thus reducing our certified time in order to purchase classified time and push in and then support in the general ed setting. Once again, it becomes an IEP team discussion, which could potentially have impact if the student's placement really needs to be in a more specialized setting, and if that teacher doesn't have HQ requirements, are we then looking at an alternative certificate as the only graduation option for that student? We talked about licensure. We talked about how could we get our special ed teachers core content certified. We're talking about four instructional areas, and I have had teachers who have strong math backgrounds try to take the math competency test, and they're like, I just can't do it. I can't remember how to do calculus. So they're very rigorous tests, which is what we want. We want really strong math teachers who are teaching high school math. But for our special education teachers to get core content certified, it's just unrealistic for us to do that by the timeline of June 30th. Another note, following this rule, I'm on another committee with local universities looking at licensure requirements for special education teachers, and the universities are not preparing their special education teachers to have these multiple certifications. They have some programs that are dual licensure programs where you could get a math certification and a special ed teacher certification, but there's also this just straight special ed teacher track, which really limits some of the options and opportunities for the special education teacher for what they can teach and what kind of courses they can teach. And then I just gave kind of an example of a master schedule, and my building principals kind of laughed at me, this is not what a master schedule looks like, but I was just trying to figure out how we could look at purchasing or looking at our core content teachers who are content certified and looking at the modified diploma requirements and how you might say, well, in year one for students, I need to have an English language arts course in the general ed setting and one in math, and then year two and building that way. So as you're looking at what am I going to reduce in order to add this opportunity or what that would look like. We haven't come up with a plan yet. We're still working on it. But this is just from a district perspective. These are the conversations that we're having that are resulting, which are, for us, are frightening around what limitations may be for students who really need more of a restrictive environment for their special education needs. So,
And I can talk to you a little bit about the ALC looks like. The ALC stands for Academic Learning Center, and we have about 22 to 24 students in it. They have various disabilities, but the one thing almost all the students share in common is that their IQs are between 50 and 70. So that's about where they're functioning IQ-wise. We do mainstream, like she mentioned. The students in my program currently take us, I also have a half-time ALC teacher, Mr. Massey. The students in our program take Mr. Massey and I for classes such as health, science, math, literature. That's about it, yeah. And science, excuse me. And we do mainstream them for other classes such as acting, PE, art, things like that. So they are out there with their general ed population, but two of the four periods a day, they're usually with us. And we've had some success with our students. Post-high school, that's what we're trying to prepare them for. Our main goal of the ALC is to get our kids to be contributing members of society upon graduation. And some of them go to the community transition program. Some of them choose to try and get a job. Some of them have tried Job Corps, but Job Corps it seems like Job Corps has possibly raised their minimum standards a little, and a lot of our kids that we thought would be able to get into it, they're now saying your student doesn't have the minimum standards to get into our program. So CTP, the Community Transition Program, is one of the more common avenues they take after graduation. But the goal that Mr. Massey and I have for our students is to become contributing members of society and not a burden on society. That's what we want them to do. They are more than capable of getting a job. They could get a job at Dairy Queen or Thriftway or Costco. And so the skills we teach them in our class are real life skills, skills that they need to be able to function in society and be able to function as an employee. We're not teaching them things that perhaps students that are on the college route need to know, because those things aren't just applicable in real life for our kids. So those are the things we teach them in our class, and we love our kids. They are wonderful. You talk to them, and socially, you wouldn't know they have a disability at all, but you give them an academic test, and it becomes very obvious that they have a disability in one area or another. Our class size, like I said before, is about 22 on average students. I talked to the counselors at LOA to see what the average class size for other core areas would be. And for a social studies class, we'd be looking at 32 students versus our 22 students. Language arts, 44 students versus our 22 students. Math is 34 students. An average health class is 35. Science is 34. Our students tend to do a little bit better in smaller settings than a class with 44 other students reading Shakespeare. Truth be told, our kids don't necessarily need to know Shakespeare to be contributing members of society. They just don't.
Is it possible their lives might be better, though, if they have access to learning Shakespeare, that their quality of life, they might just enjoy it because they like Shakespeare?
Sure, absolutely. We might have a kid or two that's like, wow, that is so cool. Yes, I shouldn't make blanket statements like that. I apologize. But, yeah, we could have some, absolutely. We could absolutely have some. But like I said, our main goal is to get them ready to be contributing members of society. And, I mean, I guess if there's a manager at Thriftway that wants them to quote Hamlet every once in a while, that's great. But we really do prefer them to get the kind of skills they're going to need in the real world. So, for instance, in our math class, we teach them how to tip a waiter. You know, that's the kind of stuff they need to know. We teach them how to come up with an area in case they get a job at Home Depot and they need to cut carpet for somebody. They need to come up with the area of the carpet, things like that. So the skills we're teaching them are I would consider more real-world skills.
So
So I would just add to that, though, at Sunset High School, for example, we have students in our academic learning center that are attending algebra, just general education algebra. So it just, it is very student specific, and a lot of that is determined by the IEP team to say, okay, what is appropriate for, you know, what is the goal for the student? We have post-secondary transition goals, and what's the course of study that's going to get the student there? And then we look at those options. So if it's, if working with, in Rome's class is the appropriate class for them to be, they're there. If it, going to one of the math teachers or the science teacher's class is appropriate, the team looks at that conversation.
And the challenge for us is, as a district, in our building, in our high schools, is that the students, depending on their level of need, of academic level, might be most appropriate in a smaller setting in our ALC classes, working at maybe a fifth grade level of math or a third grade level of reading. Other students in the program, by the time they're a senior, might be ready to access an algebra class or a literature class that we offer at our school. But with the shift in the highly qualified requirements, we potentially may not be able to allow that broad range of options for students, and instead would have to place all of our students from our ALC into our general education classes and then try to modify their curriculum within that class. And so I would be going to my algebra teacher and my ninth grade English teachers and my physics teacher and social studies teachers and saying, you have 35 students, general ed. You also have these two students here that I need you to modify to the third grade level, please, and make sure that they are getting functional math skills to be able to work at Costco or at Fred Meyer and be able to count change or tip a waiter or whatever their skill might be within the algebra classroom, or find basic areas, but geometry is working on, you know, their much higher level skills. And so the disservice to the students who are operating at a lower content level is really what's hard to watch. In addition, our ALC teachers are trained K-8. They have the multiple subject tests that they've passed. They have the skills to teach students below eighth grade. Our high school teachers, they're trained 9-12. That's what their certificate says. They are content experts for high school. They don't necessarily have, some of them may, but by and large, they don't have the skills to teach at a third or fifth grade level. Perhaps maybe seventh or eighth, because we do have students that are in our resource programs that are modified and are working at a little bit higher level, but our ALC students are much lower, and having our students from our ALC not receive those services at the level that they need, I'm not sure how that would go. The other concern is that our ALC students don't just have academic needs. They have a variety of social skill needs, behavioral needs. Our teachers, Rome, I'm sure, can talk about this too, but they may be teaching a history lesson. But in the midst of it, there's something going on in the classroom where they need to work on how just to be polite with each other or how to apologize for something they did. So they're teaching life skills and social skills amongst their history lessons and right as they're teaching in their math lessons. That is not something that's going to happen in our general education classes because there's 35 students. They're working on a chemistry lesson. You can't stop and focus on those behavioral needs or social needs of a group of 10 to 20 students like our ALC students are able, or teachers are able to do in our class currently. And so I think it would be such an impact to our students and the ability to get the skills they really do need to be those contributing members that you're talking about and have the skills to function well.
She's correct. We will often stop a lesson and do a social skill from that topic we just talked about, and that is very relevant for a lot of our kids because a lot of our kids do have some social skills that are lacking, and we need to be able to embed those in our lesson plans, and a general ed teacher just wouldn't be able to do that. It's not very feasible for them to stop and say, hey, let's talk about how we politely talk to someone in this situation we do that all the time, and it's really important because, for those kids to be able to get a job at Thriftway or Fred Meyer, they have to have a certain amount of social skills that maybe they're just not aware of. So she's exactly right on that point.
The other...
So I'm just noticing the clock. So I was thinking maybe we could wrap up if there's quick questions for this panel and then going on to Sarah and then the discussion at the end after everything. But I'll let you finish up.
Oh, there was one of the suggestions Danielle has on her sheet is that we move all students to an extended or alternative certificate. And that's a conversation we can have with families, except I know from being in many IEP meetings that families really want that diploma, whether it's a modified diploma, standard diploma, but they want the certificate that says something diploma. And that's a hard conversation. I don't want to have that conversation, so I'd like to find...
Yeah, and I have to just credit my administrative team in Beaverton. That was not an option at all for students, and so we're trying to find a workaround for that. But for us, that's just not... We wouldn't do that.
All have to do something different.
Yeah. Well, and I think the statute is pretty clear. Every high school has to have the resources for every student to access a standard, modified, or extended diploma. And access to regular classes, even if you have a low IQ.
Exactly.
Oh,
yeah.
Right. Oh, but that's why we have kids who get a range.
Sarah.
Yes. Is it not on here?
So can I ask a question while we're waiting for the technology? So on the modified diploma, even it's 24 credits,
right?
But only 12 of them are identified, and a good number of them are in areas where you say the kids are...
So we have elective opportunities. We have a pretty extensive work opportunity experience program in our district. So we look at a range of elective opportunities like music, PE, band, drama, all of those options. But additionally, we have a work experience opportunity where we're really working on work skills. So like at Westview and Sunset High School, we have a functioning T-shirt business where groups within the... So like the basketball team, for instance, will pay money for our work experience program to make T-shirts. So we've actually taken away local business because we have this wonderful program where kids are getting, it's not just like janitorial work, which is we have moved really hard away from just the basic what once was a work experience opportunity, but saying we want kids to obtain employable skills, and many of those students who graduate with a modified diploma then go to our community transition program, and we have pretty extensive partnerships with local businesses to work on career-related skills for students. So that becomes a big part of their 12 credits that are non-core credits for students. I'm ready.
Great, thank you. Chair Gilser and the members of the task force, I'm here to give a little background about highly qualified and special education. And listening to the folks here from Beaverton really highlights for me some pretty large, I think, gaps and misunderstanding in what needs to happen with highly qualified definitions, and then how that does or doesn't interface with granting of credit. So I'm going to do a little tutorial on highly qualified. HQT is the fast way to say it, so I'll try and move along pretty quickly. There's a definition of highly qualified teacher in ESEA, which is the Elementary Secondary Education Act, and in the IDEA, which is the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And this states that in wanting to improve teacher quality, it requires that teachers of core academic subjects to be highly qualified. And this came out several years ago. And the definition goes on. I think you have a handout that talks about those teachers that are the primary providers of core academic instruction need to be highly qualified. And those core academic classes have been further specified as English, reading or language arts, math, science, foreign languages of those three types, civics and government, economics, arts, history, and geography. So that is delineated in both of the education acts, the ESEA. So there's a determination of who is HQT, who meets the requirement. And a qualified teacher is one who's fully licensed by the state, has at least a bachelor's degree, and has demonstrated competency in either the K-6, we're K-8 here in Oregon, or demonstrated competence in each subject taught 7-12. So back starting in 2007, states were required to have a measurable objective that 100% of the required teachers must be HQT. So it goes way back, 7 years ago, if we're in 2014. It also includes charter and alternative education teachers. What I'm sharing about today is sort of the special ed teacher who is in a public school program. So in our state, we're well aware of the different full state licenses, standard, basic, the three initial, five-year elementary and secondary, continuing one, national board certified, alternate route to teaching, or the charter school registry. So let's get into sort of the issue related to special education teachers. And special education teachers who are teaching core academic subjects need to have the full state certification, and it can be obtained through an alternative route, pass the state special ed teacher licensing exam, and to make sure that they are licensed to teach in their particular state as a special ed teacher, that this teacher has not had the certification or licensure requirements waived on an emergency temporary provisional basis, and they hold at least a bachelor's degree. So, different from ESEA, and I'm sorry I'm sort of turned this way and most people are sitting here, the IDEA, the Individuals with Disability Education Act, has within it an alternate route to certification that is specific for special education teachers. And it is making sure that a teacher receives high-quality professional development, participates in a program of intensive supervision, assumes the function of a special ed teacher for a finite period of time, not to exceed 3 years, and then demonstrates the satisfactory progress towards the full certification. I think this, I'll call it a support program, it's an alternative route, is not widely understood or implemented in public schools or in school districts. Here in Oregon, it means that if I am a special ed teacher and I have been asked to teach a core subject for special ed students who, you know, need that particular class, there can be a specific program put into support so that in 3 years I meet the highly qualified status, but in the meantime I would be reported in the district and to the state as not highly qualified for that period of time. But if I am making the progress and I have the support, I'll go back. Professional development, a program and a plan that's laid out that consists of guidance, probably a mentor teacher, time that I'm meeting with someone to learn that, like through a mentoring program, etc. That I am not taking more than 3 years to learn this and then prove to meet the highly qualified teacher for that content area. So I believe, just from, you know, sort of what Danielle has said in questions that have come up at our office, that this is not widely known and it's allowable under the IDEA. It's not for a general ed teacher who's trying to become highly qualified in math, but it's related specifically to special education. So if we have a special ed teacher who is teaching towards alternative achievement standards. And Rome, I don't know exactly, you know, but some of the students are probably working towards alternative achievement and taking the extended assessment in your program. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So So if there is a special ed teacher is teaching to alternate achievement standards, when used with respect to a special ed teacher who teaches core academic subjects exclusively to children who are assessed against an alternate achievement standard, they have to meet the applicable requirements that we just talked about for an elementary or secondary teacher. And so this is just if people wanted to go back to look at the ESEA or IDEA and where this sits. So that if my students in the program that I have are working towards sort of alternate achievement levels up into the eighth grade, I need to be highly qualified to the eighth grade, not to 9, 10, 11, or 12. And so I need to have that knowledge and appropriate level of instruction for the students that I am teaching. Questions about this? I'll keep going because I know I'm trying to. Danielle mentioned there are a couple different ways that a teacher can demonstrate subject matter competency. Take the state exam, complete major coursework, hold a graduate degree. There's also something called HOUSE, which looks at specific number of points in different areas, whether you're becoming highly qualified at the elementary level or secondary level. 60 points for elementary, 100 points for secondary. But it looks at sort of the background experience, degree, and things like that of the teacher. So what I'm hearing here, very much so from my colleagues from Beaverton, is that the highly qualified teacher status is being confused with the teacher's ability to grant credit. Nowhere in ESEA or the IDEA does it say that if you're not highly qualified, you can't give credit. It doesn't. They don't intersect at all. Our state and every state strives to have 100% highly qualified teachers in the areas that are required. We're at 93, 95. Other states are at 95, 97. Teachers come and go, and there are teachers who are on the alternate special education teachers who are within the alternate routes to certification who are within that three-year period becoming with supporting a supporting teacher, a mentor teacher, the slides that I showed previously. So for 3 years, they would be listed as not highly qualified, but that doesn't mean that the kids that they're who are in their classes aren't getting credit for the classes that they're taking. So I think there's also and Danielle spoke to it here, that there's confusion that is leading people to make different choices in a diploma that a student is getting. I mean, they showed sort of go through this and, you know, what do we need to make a different decision for students? And we don't want to go there. And there isn't anything that says being not highly qualified doesn't mean you can't give credit. I mean, you have to have a teacher's license to be a special ed teacher, but if I'm not highly qualified in math and I am being mentored, I have my supported program, I'm going to take the test in 2 years' time and become highly qualified in math, I'm still teaching math to the students who are in the program or in my classroom. So highly qualified status and implementation, though I think the big questions are coming at the secondary level, there are questions coming at the elementary level as well. I just wanted to highlight it wasn't only a secondary issue. So I found a couple of questions that have been posed. If I'm a special ed teacher and I am just providing supplemental instruction to a core content area, I don't need to be highly qualified in that area. So let's say I have a learning resource center of some sort. My students are taking math from someone else and come to me in a different period, and we pre-teach all of the stuff that's going to be happening, and I'm doing supplemental work. I don't need to be highly qualified in math because my assignment is supplemental to core instruction that they're receiving somewhere else. There's another question here. If I am a special ed teacher and I'm consulting with regular ed teachers, that's my role in my assignment is to consult and provide support kinds of things, modifying lessons, providing accommodations, those kinds of things. I don't need to be highly qualified in that content area because the student is receiving that core content from another teacher. But I have to be special ed certified. The other thing just to note is that solely due to a special education teacher not being highly qualified, it can't be a reason for a family bringing a due process hearing or concern to a school district. It can never, it can't stand on its own. There can't be just a dispute that the teacher is not highly qualified. It isn't a reason, and the law in the IDEA specifically says that. So nothing in this part shall be construed to create a right of action that claiming that a teacher is not highly qualified cannot serve as a basis for a due process or relief. So that also tells us that there isn't this sort of not highly qualified, no granting of credit kind of thing. So I listed, you know, I know that people have referenced, you know, I don't know the conversation that Danielle had in September and how sort of folks went off down a path thinking that highly qualified and granting of credit were somehow tied when they're not. I know that there has been several presentations from ODE through Title I and some of the other programs that also touch teacher effectiveness and highly qualified status. And I know that there's a paper online that looks like this that I think is confusing in the way some of it is worded that has led people to perhaps think they're tied together. What has happened this year, which I think has been very helpful, is that with the reorganization and I think desire of myself and other people in the department to be involved in some of the highly qualified questions that come through. In the past, it had been solely the responsibility through, used to be called EII, now is the Instruction and Standards section, and they were trying to answer a lot of questions that came through special ed, or not through special ed, came as a result of, you know, confusion about the highly qualified status as a special ed teacher, and we're trying to answer those on their own and not sort of coming towards student services and asking, you know, how we might be able to be supportive. What we have developed since last year is a core team of people who meet regularly, because I think the questions get sort of not shuffled, but given to Janet Buble when she's out on a Title I review or something like that, or Anna Haley when people are trying to do some course code kinds of things. And so we've put together a group of people who try to answer together those specific questions that are specific to highly qualified status of a special education teacher. And that's where I learned that the alternative route for that supportive program over a 3-year period of time for a special ed teacher to become highly qualified could be utilized more probably instead of, you know, sort of coming up with all of these alternate plans. I don't know how else to describe it. So I'll stop there. I went 5 minutes over, and
It was great. It was great. All of you were great.
I spoke too fast.
So are there questions, comments, clarifications for either of the panels or presentations that we just had on this issue?
Lots of concerns. We're in the same boat as Aloha and Sunset. I'm just trying to schedule kids or schedule teachers to be in front of kids where it's in the best interest of the kid, but also that works, because I get it that there's not confusion in ability to grant credit if a teacher is on that alternative pathway, but ours aren't. One wouldn't do it. I mean, it could come to you have to, or if you'd like to get a paycheck, but he's really good, too. I don't think that's the answer for kids. And so it's really a tough one. It's also...
Give me, so I understand sort of, give a little more detail about what he teaches, and just so I have a better understanding of your scenario.
Well, an LRC teacher who is toward the end of his career, who doesn't really want to be have rigorous professional development or an intensive supervision program, But maybe that's the wrong example. I have another teacher who works primarily with kids in reading and writing, and she's tried to pass a praxis test, and she hasn't been able to. But she's, you know, perfectly capable and skilled at teaching kids where they are. We've pushed LRC teachers in the co-teaching model, and it's great. It's really, really expensive. And I would do that every time if we could. It's great for kids. It's great for both teachers. And the data's good. But, gosh, I can't, you know, that's cutting music. That's the implications of that. And so, you know, it's really hard. I think also we've been hampered by IEPs at some time. Because an IEP will say that a kid needs a specific study skills class, and I want the kid in a writing intervention class taught by a regular ed English teacher because I think the kid can meet his benchmarks. But I can't fit it in the schedule along with the study skills class. And, you know, if I have a four-month lag time to get an IEP changed, the ship has sailed. And so just there are all sorts of questions and concerns that I have. And so I'm very interested in where you land. And
yeah, and I'm the one representing special ed directors, but I know that this is a larger issue because the interpretation that is coming is that if you're not HQ, you can't award credit, which is then getting to this extreme decision-making that we're like, put on the brakes, but there's a timeline that districts are told of that they have to be highly qualified by June 30th, 2014, and if they're not, they can't teach that course next year. So it's the dance of, I think it will end up becoming a bigger issue because there's not clear, not that you're not clear, Sarah, but it's not just a special education issue. It's a general education issue because there are students who are not in special education working towards modified diplomas and what's happening that with that in terms of course codes and things, those pieces. So it becomes, when we talk about diploma options, another layer of the multiple diploma options becomes this licensure piece and who can award those diploma option credits, and so it becomes a bigger system issue that, like you said, Raina, it gets to me at some point, but I may be the counselor in the building and my district administrator may know that, but it may take 2 years before it lands. So it's how do you have a more effective communication system around diploma, licensure, and all of those other pieces so that districts and, like, you know, Matt, as a building principal, feels supported in master scheduling.
Can I ask a question so I better understand? You talked about, you know, a deadline for some teachers coming this spring or something about being highly qualified. Is it, does it go back to some teachers who have not become highly qualified since 2007, 8, 9, 10?
No, they were...
They
were just
year?
This year.
Okay. And
identified.
Special ed teachers?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's helpful for me to know. Is it, are you trying to move or is there some movement to for those who are interested or who want to do the alternate route to HQT under
We haven't
IDA?
Been given, so that becomes the disconnect, I think, in these, because You are telling me this, but we hear something else. And so it's how are we as a department, as all of those pieces, how is the instruction standards department or whatever they're called now talking to the special ed department so it's a seamless communication? And that's not what's happening.
Okay. Well, I wanted to clarify that I knew the, you know, it wasn't teachers from 5 years ago that this is
no.
The last time or something. Okay.
Well, I think, too, some districts, certainly mine, included. I don't know that HR would allow us the 3-year window of being, you know, of having teachers grant credits that as not highly qualified teachers. They're very they're just very strict about that. to use a diplomatic word, and I think that hurts kids too. But and so I think they'd say absolutely not to this alternative path. That they'd say find the highly qualified teacher. So I'm sure of that. I'm going to take it back tomorrow though and see, because I didn't know anything about it.
And there's parameters around it, and we all know that special education teachers and related service personnel, you know, are one of the critical areas of recruiting and retaining. And this option has been a part of the IDEA since 2007, I think, and is a way to be supportive, provide some good professional development for teachers, but then it doesn't, you know, go on forever. Somebody needs to make a commitment and do that. But it doesn't have to be about going back and getting another, you know, bachelor's degree or something like that. It's another alternate route.
Any further questions or comments? That was a really overwhelming discussion to think about. I mean, the theme that keeps coming back is the dissemination of information and how it flows from what the intent is to what people know and what they can do and how to solve the problems.
And
in this area and every other.
It does. And it's, you know, not, it's, we need to do it collectively. And where the misinformation is in the special ed arena, and becoming a pretty cohesive team so that when the special ed plans, support plans, professional development, those questions come up, that you know, we can do it together and then learn together, you know, be able to provide information cohesively as a group. So this has been helpful to me in terms of some of the questions that have been probably posed to ed specialists and to, you know, Janet and or Anna that we might not be aware of.
And I would just say part of that conversation is not just a special ed conversation, because like you said, Matt, it's the HR directors and the counselors who are having to look at some of those pieces, or the building principals, because I may be the bearer of all knowledge that is special ed, but I'm not making all of those decisions. And that goes to the site, you know, if your transcript doesn't communicate, if your licensure doesn't communicate, I as a special ed director can say, I think it's a good idea to have an M next to that course, or I can build a model of articulating courses so that we know which course codes align to modified, but then I'm owning that, and how do you then get that so everyone's doing that seamlessly across the state?
About the HR. Do you think it's coming from trying to reach the 100% and so to never have lower than 100%? Okay.
Well, thank you all very much for participating, and especially to everyone that gave presentations today, and Joel for coming into a whole new topic area. Thank you for being so brave to dive in and for coming down. And we'll send out information about the next meeting. Do we have a next meeting date?
We had talked about March 14th for the next meeting date, which is a Friday. Does that work for Fridays? Work best for everyone? 10:30-ish.
That was what we were. Yeah, I think we were looking at March 14th at 10:30-ish. And so we'll send it out, and we'll hear back from you. And anything else for the good of the order before we're done? No. Nope. Thank you all very much for staying the extra 15 minutes. We're done. Thank you very much for staying the extra 15 minutes. We're done.